This is Holiday Readings and Remembrances, reflections on the season as told by members of the Northern Michigan University and surrounding communities. I'm Stan Wright. Today we hear from author and Northern Michigan University professor of English, John Smolens.
It's difficult to imagine the holiday season without snow. In song and rhyme, on greeting cards and gift catalogs, the image of a white Christmas is, as Bing Crosby croons endlessly this time every year, a dream. In places where it is unlikely to snow, Christmas lights seem tawdry, and yard displays of Santa's sleigh and reindeer lose their magic. Here in northern Michigan, when it doesn't snow in December, a genuine anxiety sets in as the days dwindle toward Christmas Eve. There's no relief quite like that first morning when I get up and look out at a fresh blanket of snow. What exactly is snow? Bernard Mergen's fine book, Snow in America, examines snow from scientific, cultural, literary, and artistic perspectives, demonstrating that throughout our history, snow has been one of the most elementary and cohesive forces in the human experience. Snow is a cluster of ice crystals that form around an invisible speck of matter, a piece of dust drifting high in the atmosphere. And in a process called sublimation, the crystals continue to accumulate about the speck, causing it to gain weight and descend toward the earth. The common perception is that no two snowflakes are alike. We believe this thanks to a Vermont farmer named Wilson Alwyn Bentley, who, between 1884 and 1911, spent his winters photographing thousands of snowflakes. The design of each snowflake is determined by numerous factors, including the dimensions of the nuclei and air temperature. Just below 32 degrees, water crystallizes into single hexagonal plates about the speck of dust. Between 27 and 23 degrees, the crystals resemble needles. From 23 to 18 degrees, the crystals form prismatic hollow columns. At lower temperatures, the crystals often create the star or tree-shaped snowflakes known as dendrites. A snowflake descends at a rate of about 1 foot per second. The more aerodynamic needle-shaped flakes fall faster than dendrites. And depending on the wind currents and weather conditions, a snowflake can be airborne from a few minutes to 5 or 6 hours. Snow has been a metaphor in literature at least as far back as Homer, who wrote some 9,000 years ago words like winter snowflakes. Certain languages have many words for snow, each defining a different condition or property. The Eskimo language has two root words for snow, quanik for snow in the air and aput for snow on the ground. In Russian and Siberian languages, there are dozens of linguistic distinctions regarding snow. The word nast, for instance, describes the thickened crust on the surface of a mature snow cover. Yet if the crust is so thin that it cannot support the weight of a man, hunters and traders in Siberia call it skovorta, which inexplicably means frying pan. However, we still haven't given a name to all the various kinds of snow. For example, what do you call those heavy chunks of snow and ice that build up behind the wheels of your car? Some often so tight to the front tires that they inhibit your ability to steer. You may call them names when you bruise your big toe while trying to kick them loose, but we have yet to give them a proper name. Certainly they deserve their own word, one that is neither mellifluous nor pretty. They're not exactly snow, nor are they slush. Perhaps we should call them snurl. Writers never tire of describing snow and its effects upon us. Emily Dickinson once described the ruts in a dirt road as filling with alabaster wool, and Farley Mowat has written about a psychological condition he calls snowphilia. Recalling his childhood in Wales, Dylan Thomas wrote, "One Christmas was so much like another that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and 6 nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. Some writers have suggested that snow contains secret knowledge of life's mysteries. One 19th century newspaper column began, "My subject is snow, which I propose treating in the manner following. First, of the beauties of snow. Second, of the music of snow. Third, of the pleasures of snow. Fourth, of the benefits of snow. Fifth, of the moral teachings of snow." For others, the lessons to be learned from snow are not so easily gleaned. While musing beside Walden Pond, Henry David Thoreau came to the conclusion that snow possesses a code that needs to be broken. "This plain sheet of snow which covers the ice of the pond," he wrote, "is not a blankness as yet unwritten, but such as is unread." Early in the 20th century, a humorist observed that the snow shovel will find the boundary line between two lots more accurately than the best surveyor. Perhaps he was a neighbor of Robert Frost. Bernard Mergen categorizes what he calls the many useful metaphors in snow. Throughout literature, snow has come to represent negation or nothingness, including isolation, silence, death, and the unknown. Or it can suggest love, purity, and fragility. Other times, snow represents the tension between order and chaos in nature. And of course, snow is often associated with memory, especially the recollections of childhood. The artist's relationship to snow may be summed up by Richard Hugo, who wrote in Snow Poem, "To write a snow poem, you must ignore the snow falling outside your window." The relentless nature of snow often reminds us of the inevitable fate we all share. One of the most famous passages regarding snow and mortality is in James Joyce's story, The Dead, which concludes, "Snow was general all over Ireland. It was falling on every part of the dark central plain, on the treeless hills, falling softly upon the Bog of Allen, and farther westward softly falling into the dark mutinous Shannon waves. It was falling, too, upon every part of the lonely churchyard on the hill where Michael Fury lay buried. It lay thickly drifted on the crooked crosses and headstones, on the spears of the little gate, on the barren thorns. His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe and faintly falling like the descent of their last end upon all the living and the dead." But snow also affirms our hopes and dreams. It can crystallize a time and place forever in our memories. It can confirm our moment in the world. One of my favorite passages comes from the opening paragraph of John Cheever's novel, The Wapshot Scandal. "The snow began to fall into St. Botolph's at 4:15 on Christmas Eve. Old Mr. Jowett, the station master, carried his lantern out onto the platform and held it up into the air. The snowflakes shone like iron filings in the beam of his light, although there was really nothing there to touch. The fall of snow exhilarated and refreshed him and drew him, full-souled, it seemed, out of his carapace of worry and indigestion. The afternoon train was already an hour late, and the snow, whose whiteness seems to be a part of our dreams since we take it with us everywhere, came down with such open-handed velocity, such swiftness, that it looked as if the village had severed itself from its context on the planet and were pressing its roofs and steeples up into the air."
Holiday Readings and Remembrances is a Public Radio 90 production produced at the WNMU-FM studios in the Learning Resources Center on the campus of Northern Michigan University. I'm your producer and host, Stan Wright. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays.